You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Every place carries a history, from forests and wildlife to the eventuality of roads and buildings, and all the communities of people who lay claim to a space and call it home. For those who have called and continue to call Bayview Hunters Point in southeast San Francisco home, that history comes with a heavy burden, one steeped in abandonment, in racial and economic injustice, and in toxicity that is embedded in the ground and moving through the air. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. A new book looks at that history, but also at the activism for environmental justice that Black Bayview Hunters Point residents have been seeking for years. For more, I'm speaking with Lindsay Dillon, assistant professor of sociology at UC Santa Cruz, and author of Toxic City, Redevelopment and Environmental Justice in San Francisco, which will be released on April 9th. Lindsay Dillon, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation on In-Depth.
Thank you for having me.
So I've had the great fortune to read this book and really dig into the topic here, which dig in, I think, is the right terminology to use, because not only in a technical sense, because there's so much to do with the environment and with ecology and all of that, but also just layers upon layers of information and stories in here. So I think I want to start with what pulled you into the story of Bayview Hunters Point.
Well, I think there are two answers to that. The first is that, I lived in San Francisco in the early to mid 2000s, and I ended up volunteering at a garden in Bayview Hunters Point that was really close to the shipyard. I say this in the book, but as I was driving to the garden with other volunteers, we would drive down 3rd Street, which is kind of the main street in the neighborhood. And it was being kind of torn up to build this new light rail line. And living in the city, I was aware of concerns around gentrification in the Mission District and throughout. I mean, this was 20 years ago. So I started, just paying attention to that. And then I started a geography PhD program at UC Berkeley. And I was interested in that respect in cities and ecologies. And, it just got me thinking about my experience going to Bayview Hunters Point and the felt difference in that place and other places in San Francisco, and thinking about the history of that, how people in that neighborhood had been organizing to change things and kind of like envisioning a different kind of city. Those two experiences, my sort of academic interest in cities and ecologies, and then my experience living in San Francisco and gardening in Bayview Hunters Point, came together in this book.
This really opened my eyes to a variety of stories that maybe they're heard, but not as much as one would think, especially when I think a lot of times people think of San Francisco, they're thinking of specific areas of the city and maybe not taking into consideration what's happening right around the corner. And you touch on so much in this book, but if you can give a little bit of the history that you discovered when it comes to the neighborhoods there and the Black community members there and what's been going on over the past, we're talking since the 30s, 40s, even before.
I agree with you that neighborhoods like Bayview Hunters Point have been historically ignored. I mean, that's part of the one thread of the book is the history of abandonment and the ways residents over many decades, I would say multiple generations, have resisted that abandonment and sort of envisioned a different neighborhood and in a different city. And I don't think the story of Baby Hunter's Point is particularly unique in the United States. At the same time, what I think was interesting to me about Baby Hunter's Point, and has been increasingly so since I started working on this project, is the relevance of that neighborhood to the future of the city in terms of, you know, development and housing, and sort of it's been, you know, portrayed as like the next frontier of gentrification. And I mean, these concerns about who gets to live in San Francisco are taking place all over the city, but increasingly so in Baby Hunter's Point. So it's no longer the neglected corner of the city. In fact, it's a site where real estate companies and speculators are like interested in, you know, buying up property and making money. So I was sort of interested in the history of that abandonment and what it means for a place now to become valued, and for there to be kind of like real estate interest and interest by city planners and so forth. So, and then the experience of people who live there and what they would have wanted. So the book actually goes all the way back to Spanish colonialism, very briefly. But I like, as a geographer and as a historical geographer, I'm really interested in the kind of like the deep histories of a place. So I do go back thinking about how this particular area of San Francisco was like a valued place for Ohlone tribes, what happened when Spanish missionaries came, and how this area was eventually incorporated into what became the city of San Francisco. And I talk about how it was, from the late 19th century onwards, an industrial place. So if you think about this, you know, the geography of San Francisco and the kind of the center being Market Street, and sort of that area becoming a more kind of cosmopolitan city. As I say in the book, it was because of the mining that was going on in Sierra Nevada, San Francisco was becoming this like center of finance in the U.S. West Coast. And that was, that development in the center of the city was like pushing all of these kind of noxious industries. So industries that were like very smelly or waste producing to the southeast. So that's the history. And then, you know, on the eve of World War II, the U.S. Navy took over the dry docks, which are places where ships can be like repaired or built in southeast San Francisco. This is the Hunter's Point shipyard. And the Navy sort of built out the shipyard into this really important naval base that serviced ships during World War II. At the same time, during World War II, there had been, since 1910, a migration of Black Americans out of the U.S. South, headed to industrial cities in the North and in the Midwest. And World War II and all the job opportunities and all of the investment that the federal government put into California, and especially Bay Area shipyards, both private and military, this was a huge opportunity, and it shifted the geography of the Great Migration. And so you had, after 1942, boom towns around the Bay Area. So Richmond, Oakland, the area that is now Marin City, and San Francisco, just became huge communities and networks of African Americans leaving the South or Midwest, arrived in the Bay Area, and, you know, set up home and developed families and communities. And Hunter's Point was one of the shipyards that, you know, employed Black Americans. And Hunter's Point itself became a residential neighborhood. It was a mixed neighborhood, but it had, I think, a third of the 10,000 or so people who lived there were African American, and they were all, you know, working at the shipyards and so forth. And so, you know, after the war, there was a lot of demographic shifts in that largely white families were able to leave the sort of military kind of temporary military housing structures that had been built in Hunters Point, and they were able to kind of move into other areas of the Bay, relying on, you know, federal housing, mortgage loans, and so forth. And so you see across the country at this time, like a kind of a white suburbanization, and then a concentration of Black and people of color in inner cities or kind of deteriorating urban areas. And that, and Hunters Point is definitely part of that kind of larger post-war American story. And so, you know, by, you know, the early 1960s, Hunters Point is, you know, 97% Black. It's an industrial area. And it's, you know, over-policed. And, you know, this is where my story of activism really starts in the book. And in thinking about how Black Hunters Point residents, and particularly Black women, organized to rebuild the neighborhood and kind of envision a different kind of city in the Southeast San Francisco. And I think it's a really important story, broadly speaking, because in histories of San Francisco, Baby Hunters Point is a footnote, or it's not part of like common sense histories of San Francisco in the 60s. But I think it's such an important story. And as I read and through the archives and I read about these really spectacular people and what they were imagining, I just felt like it was such an important story that needed to be told, and a version of San Francisco that needed to be more part of people's understanding of the city.
Yeah, I appreciate, one, just the amount of history that you do get into in the book, because history isn't just forgotten, right? It is carried along, whether you see it or not. It's a part of the landscape. It's a part of the lives that are there. But the heart of this book is with the communities and the neighborhoods there who have been working to envision a space that is truly theirs to occupy. And we mentioned, you know, back in the early part of the conversation here, gentrification. And one term in the book that I hadn't thought of before, and the context of it was green gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
So with all that they've tried to do in the Bayview Hunters Point area, a lot has not really succeeded. Is there a space for those neighborhoods, those communities in Bayview Hunters Point, in the green urban future that's being really now very much a huge part of what's being proposed?
Yeah, I mean, my answer is yes, but let me like get us there. So green gentrification is not my term, but I do think it applies to at least a large part of what's going on in Bayview Hunters Point. So gentrification is, you know, the pricing out. And although some people actually think about it not just as physical displacement, but like cultural or psychological displacement, and like living in a place, but suddenly it starts to change and the Whole Foods comes in and so forth, and you don't necessarily feel like you're of the place. So I think there's also this kind of level of like belonging that can accompany gentrification, even when people aren't necessarily being physically displaced. Green gentrification, it refers to the ways that so much of urban planning today is structured around forms of urban greening. So whether it's city planning departments that, for, you know, I think these are really great goals, like want to create parks and urban green spaces or restore wetlands. But I think more insidiously, it's when companies use green signifiers or kind of markers of sustainability as a way to kind of like sell homes or like generate interest in like a development project. And so I do think you see that with large urban development projects in Baby Hunters Point, broadly speaking. And so, you know, that's a particular irony is a light word. But it's a particular irony in this place because it's been so industrial. And, you know, what I didn't mention with the industrialization and the ways that the urban landscape in Hunters Point has been shaped by, you know, industries or sewage treatment plants, and right across is like, you know, residential homes. So that's, it's not a place where people or working class people have been sheltered from the, you know, air emissions or water emissions or the waste products that are generated by toxic industry. So it's an environmental justice and environmental health issue. And yet at the same time, as Baby Hunter's Point becomes more, and Southeast San Francisco in general becomes more, becomes central to the future of San Francisco and like, you know, what urban development is going to look like in the next 30 years. You know, areas in that parcels, property parcels, waterways, things are starting to get cleaned up. And so that's another kind of other form of urban greening. It's not just like planting trees in parks, but like environmental remediation, so toxic cleanup and so forth. And so that's happening as well. So you have toxic cleanup, most notably at the 500-acre Hunter's Point Shipyard, where there is radioactive waste, but also all kinds of environmental hazards. And so coinciding with that cleanup, you also have, you know, corporate interest in Baby Hunter's Point and the use of green signifiers within development projects, what scholars would call green gentrification. And so as Baby Hunter's Point is getting cleaned up, it is the case that people who can't afford to live in this area where, you know, property values and rents are going up are being pushed out. So there's a contradiction there. But to your question is like, you know, what's the place of longtime Black residents in this city, in this kind of green future? My answer would be like, there's kind of top-down or corporate urban greening, but there's also all of the kind of forms of greening that people in the neighborhood are involved in. And my book, unfortunately, doesn't go too much into that because I'm really focused on the cleanup of the shipyard and how people and the politics of that remediation. But I would just kind of raise up all the different gardening projects, or there's a doctor who's from the area who's involved in a biomonitoring project. So she's trying to trace and understand like what kinds of chemicals people have absorbed into their body. That's not really greening, but it is an example of like kind of a grassroots effort to understand the environmental health consequences of living next to so much toxic industry over time. There's just all kinds of programs where, you know, people are envisioning a green future that's inclusive and just.
In Depth will return after a moment.
Well, as you just mentioned, so much of what your book is looking at, and as the title alludes to, something that these communities have been fighting for, environmental justice, especially in relation to the toxic waste left behind. So what does environmental justice look like for those who call Bayview Hunter's Point home?
Yeah, so environmental justice you could say it's a social movement, or the term itself emerged in the 1980s in the context of a rural Black, largely Black community in the South and in North Carolina, struggling against the state of North Carolina that wanted to locate a toxic waste dump in their neighborhood. And community ended up partnering with national civil rights organizations. And through that battle, in which people were like lying down in the middle of the street to prevent these trucks from coming in and dumping PCB, you know, as a kind of a toxic chemical with really, you know, hazardous health effects in their neighborhood. So they were, you know, trying to physically block these trucks from coming into town. In the context of that campaign, which was ultimately unsuccessful, this concept of environmental racism and environmental justice emerged, and it really took hold. And it, you know, became, by the 1990s, there were all kinds of environmental just groups that were engaged in something called environmental justice. And I think the reason why it spread so quickly is because so many groups were looking at the intersection of class and race and vulnerability and environmental hazards already. And suddenly there was this kind of name for what they were doing. And you see that in Baby Hunter's Point as well. In the 1990s, there had already been a power plant that was operating there since 1928, in addition to one just north of Baby Hunter's Point in a place called Potrero Hill. So there are already two power plants going on in Southeast San Francisco. And there was this proposal to locate a third power plant there. And that really galvanized the community, and a number of groups came out of that struggle or had become involved in it. And we're talking about environmental justice and environmental racism. And they got the health department to do health studies. There was one that found that Black women in Bayview Hunter's Point had double the rates of ovarian and breast cancer than the rest of women in the city. And so there was a lot of organizing to prevent this power plant from coming into the neighborhood. And they were ultimately successful in stopping it. So it was a proposal, but it was never, that third power plant was never built. My book looks at that period, but what I find interesting is that currently in the contemporary moment, a lot of environmental justice organizing in Southeast San Francisco and Baby Hunter's Point is around redevelopment and the kind of respiratory effects of what it means to live near like a large cleanup and redevelopment site. So there's a lot of like dust and other kinds of what public health professionals would call particulate matter, just like things that are churned up through redevelopment, like large scale, like construction projects, basically. I think that it's telling that environmental justice activism in Baby Hunter's Point is also very much concerned with the Hunter's Point shipyard and the degree to which it is or isn't getting cleaned up. And in particular, what people are focused, or some people are focused on today, is whether or not sea level rise is going to impact the contamination at the site in the future. And so the struggle over what cleanup looks like and what I call the politics of cleanup or the politics of remediation is also really central to concepts of, I would say, environmental injustice. But I think, you know, one of the things that I noted or observed through my research and I tried to trace in the book is the shift in environmental justice activism from fighting against what I would consider like environmental bads, like a power plant, things you don't want in the neighborhood, to struggling against, in a really complicated way, redevelopment projects that are producing these sort of like green, eco-friendly condominium complexes, right? And even though people are just being exposed to particulate matter and dust for the duration of the development project, you know, they experience it as part of a longer history of toxic exposure. And so you have organizing that's kind of trying to monitor and protect people from these redevelopment projects that they argue have, you know, toxic or potentially toxic impacts on largely poor people who live kind of on the borders, on the edges of these new development projects. So the shift in organizing from, this is a little simplistic, from environmental bads like power plants to environmental goods, like, you know, upscale, eco-friendly, like housing developments. And so I think from the perspective, I say, of people who live near these development sites, it's part of a longer history of environmental racism, even though the city is no longer trying to put a power plant there, right? And I think, you know, to put it sort of bluntly, it speaks to kind of a disposability of low-income, largely Black people who live in this area of Hunter's Point, or the experience of disposability. So that's something my book traces. And then alongside that, I've really tried to highlight the ways that people are critiquing this and challenging it and organizing around it?
You know, this might be a hard question to answer, but I feel like it's important to ask it. Mm-hmm. As we kind of wrap up the conversation here, what is the future of Bayview Hunters Point?
I mean, I feel like I'm not the right person to answer that question. You know, being a white woman who, you know, doesn't live in Bayview Hunters Point, I feel like I'm more in a position to point to, you know, what people who live in that neighborhood and who organize you know, how they're envisioning the future of the neighborhood. And I would say that, you know, even though there has been a lot of gentrification and displacement, there's also such a rich, and, you know, the book tries to go into the long history of activism around housing and health and environment, broadly speaking. And so I think, you know, especially, I think there's a lot of young people who are, you know, working in gardens or really committed to like small scale, like Black run, small entrepreneurial businesses and so forth. The way I end the book is at a garden on Hunters Point Hill that looked down on the shipyard, and just saying that even though this is like a small example, this garden, it's an example of people staking a claim to the future. And so I think a lot of it, I mean, that story remains to be written, but to the extent that affordable housing and renter protections and basically housing justice efforts and policies can help keep people in place, there's such a vibrant, rich history and ongoing form of like community organizing in that neighborhood. And I think, you know, I hope that's the future.
If you want to find out more about community activism and action in Bayview Hunters Point, go to bvhpadvocates.org. You can hear all in-depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
Listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.